Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and you're just in time to catch a fascinating guest, Sunita Vaswani, who has written the definitive book on the complete book of Indian cooking is what it's called, and it's 350 recipes from the regions of India. So if you want a definitive book on the differences between the regions with absolutely yummy recipes for each, and they're doable, aren't they? Welcome, Sunita.
Thank you very much, Anne. I'm happy to be here.
And now, these recipes are doable for the home cook?
Absolutely. Every one of them is more than doable, and I have personally tested all of them and taught them in my home classes, so they certainly work.
And so you are from both a teacher and a writer.
That's correct. I have been, this is my 30th year of teaching classes.
Aha. Give us a little bit of your background. You came from India. You were born in?
I was born in what is now known as Mumbai, but in my day was Bombay. Actually, I don't come from a family that was, my mother, for instance, did not cook at all. But my interest in cooking was the result of our moving to New York City when I was a relatively new bride and had to fend for myself and my husband, and suddenly realized I had to learn how to feed ourselves.
And you had some trouble with ingredients, I understand.
Yes, in the beginning. We're talking in the early 60s, so that's...
Nothing. Oh, there would be nothing, huh?
Nothing. You're right. Even in New York City, we had to travel to Chinatown, which was 15 miles away, to get a bunch of cilantro. So things have improved vastly since then, and the availability of everything now is absolutely fantastic. But most of all, I realized that I enjoyed the creativity of cooking. From that came was born the love for teaching.
Now, how did you become so conversant with the different regions of India?
Well, this book actually is the result of 2 years of very intense research. I traveled on trips to India, and I met with families. I spent afternoons with the matriarch of a family in the south, and literally just by talking to people. So the book is recipes that are more family-oriented and not restaurant-oriented, even though there has been some comment about that regarding my first book. But I have to tell you, Anne, that Indian home cooking is a completely different thing to Indian restaurant cooking.
Oh, I'm sure. And the same thing is true of Chinese, I understand.
Exactly, and that's a very good comparison. So if somebody is looking for a restaurant experience, they might be disappointed. But this is the food of real people as they cook in their homes.
Could you give us some idea of the different regions and the culinary differences?
Absolutely. In the north, for instance, Kashmir and the state of Kashmir grows a lot of mustard seeds. And they season their food with mustard seeds as well as mustard oil, which is not an infusion of oil with crushed mustard seeds. It is pure extruded mustard seeds. So it's cold pressed. It's cold pressed mustard oil. Very, very strong, very, very flavorful, and absolutely wonderful if it's used correctly. And in the south, they grow a lot of sesame. So that isn't a prevalent oil there, cold pressed sesame oil. And by the way, both of these are considered to be extremely healthy because they're not just subjected to the intense heat of a lot of our refined oil.
Mm.
The rest of the country uses a lot of corn oil. So there are differences in that. And then the seasoning. There are certain seasonings that are common to the north. The commonest one that comes to mind would be garam masala, which I believe most people now are familiar with. Garam means warm. Masala is a generic word for mixture. Now, garam masala is something that exists all over the north of India, does not exist in the south. It is, in fact, transposed with a blend that they call sambar powder. That is their ubiquitous mixture of maybe 15 different spices that flavors a lot of their food. And sambar powder does not exist in North Indian cooking.
And then there's breads. I mean, everybody assumes that every Indian cuisine is big on breads.
You're right, and that is really not the case at all. The four southern states live primarily on rice, and there are more than 20 to 25 varieties of rice grown in those four states.
Now, that was surprising to me. I didn't know there were that many varieties of rice in the whole entire universe.
Well, and it varies from within 100 or 200 miles of the area. So they are very, very rice-oriented. That was quite a surprise to me, too. And the other thing is most people think in basmati rice, which we're all familiar with, is the rice of all of India, which it is not. It is grown in a very, very small part of northern India. It's a very narrow, flat alluvial plain at the base of the Himalayan mountain range. And the growing conditions there are influenced by the melting snow streams. That is where true basmati comes from.
We just had that last week. It was so good.
It is good. It has a fabulous aroma and a sort of a nutty quality which you cannot duplicate anywhere else because the growing conditions can't be duplicated. So it's really just a very small area of northern India that grows pure basmati rice. And that is the reason it is so highly prized and it is relatively expensive compared to any other rice in
right.
India.
Growing up, we had neighbors who were Kashmiri.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was totally different. The food was totally different from anything that I ever knew as Indian cuisine.
You're very right. They eat a lot of different greens that we don't see in the rest of the country, a lot of mustard oil, as I said, not too much fish because there isn't much fish
right.
in that area. However, they're very, very big on lamb. They raise sheep in the north, which in the rest of the country, it's not lamb, it's goat meat. Goat
uh-huh.
meat is the meat of choice throughout most of India. And lamb is only in the very far north, obviously, in Kashmir.
You have this yummy recipe for a Kashmiri leg of lamb from the north. It was, oh.
Now
is very, very good.
Oh.
Sunita, you mentioned off air that there is also pork to a limited extent in Indian cuisine and that the Portuguese port colony of Goa had something to do with that?
That's correct. The Portuguese were in India for 460 years, beginning in 1500, and they left Goa in 1961. So their influence on the food of that area was immense. They brought in specifically vinegar, the use of wine. They taught the local people how to make wine. The monks did. Their cuisine is influenced greatly by two or three different seasonings which you don't see too much of in other parts of the country, mainly vinegar, a lot of garlic, and a heavy dose of cumin. Their mixture is made of those three ingredients.
That's interesting. Yes. There are lots of garlic, aren't
there? Mm-hmm. Tons of garlic. They're very big on garlic. Not that much ginger, much less ginger.
Now, when you do give tours of India.
Yes, I do.
And which ought to be fascinating. Do you hit on, like, I've always wanted to see all the temple
mm-hmm.
architecture and sculpture. Do you do that, too?
Yes, I do, Anne. The problem is more and more that people have less and less time to get to India. And it is a difficult thing for me to organize a tour for less than 2 weeks. Because if it's less than that, you're really not getting anything out of that whole trip. And I do understand that going all the way to India is not something you would do more than perhaps once in your life. So yes, we do. We have a pretty intense schedule. I certainly include temples, churches. Of course, food is also a primary interest. But we do a lot of the cultural sites as well as the culinary sites.
Now, do you go into home kitchens on your tours?
I haven't so far, but the next one I'm planning, which is February 2009, is going to have some of that as well, because the people were very interested in that, and it's going to be limited to 16 people, including myself.
Wow.
I'm organizing that to go into home kitchens and get a, you know, some hands-on demonstration.
Well, listeners, this wonderful book is called Complete Indian Cooking. It's available, of course, through the OTM bookshelf. Sunita, you have a previous book as well, I think it's called Easy Indian or Simple Indian?
Yes, Easy Indian Cooking.
And all of this available through a website called www. And I'm going to let you spell it out for me, Sunita, because I'm sure I'll never get it right.
It's www.sunita, spelled S-U-N-E-E, so double E, T as in Tom, A, Baswani, BASWANI.com.
And I love that name, Sunita. Is that common?
It's relatively common, yes it is.
That's a beautiful name, isn't it?
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to have you as part of the program, Sunita.
Peter, at that time, we're going to be in Vietnam with my family.
Oh, great.
Yes, we're heading off to Vietnam and have the children and grandchildren. We'll be celebrating that in Angkor Wat, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
Well, that
we
sounds
just
like
interviewed someone who wrote Into the Vietnamese Kitchen.
Uh-huh.
Whose name was?
Andrea Nguyen.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yes.
I have not met her, but I know of her.
It's a really gorgeous book.
There's so many
books that have come out about the Southeast Asia and Asia. Everybody should start cooking them. Peter's wildly telling me that time is up here and it's time to take a break. So I thank you again, Sunita, and hopefully we'll be in touch.
Absolutely, and thank you. It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you.
And now we're going to go to a break, and we'll hope to see you on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We seem to be focused on Indian cuisine.
Well, we're focused deliberately on Indian cuisine.
We certainly are focused, and we've been eating a lot of it, actually.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We ate two dishes at the same time because we made an exciting discovery. Reading Food Arts magazine, we read about a reference to a company called Aurora Creations, and we got in touch with the founder of Aurora Creations, who's on the line right now. Jiraj, good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Good day.
And this is just an incredible business that you've built. But you built it as an entrepreneur, but you built it for a different reason as well. Tell us quickly about that.
I had to do it. I just really felt that what was in my hands, in my kitchen, in the woks, was a gift. There was an audience of foodies that didn't know there was a term that was coming called foodies.
Well, you were raised now in an Indian family, a family from North India. So that is
That's correct. Northwest India.
So Northwest.
This was my mother's home cooking.
These spices that we have then that you gave us that we've been testing, they're actually referenced in the northern Indian kitchen.
Exactly.
Okay.
These are the flavor profiles, the formulas of seasonings or in the Indian word, the masalas, that will take basic vegetables or meats and give it that authentic North Indian flair.
And you said you actually worked with them with your mother in the kitchen trying to get all the proportions correct.
We spent Sundays in a row for 9 months measuring and creating these, you know, what we like to think are these master blends.
But the great thing about them, to me, aside from the fact that they have all the right things in them and all the right in all the right quantities, which takes a lot of the mystery out of the cooking of your native region, would make it altogether too possible to make mistakes as if you didn't have it, is that once you have that spice blend, it's like a 3 or 4 step process to actually put a dish on the table.
Peter was telling you, I guess we were eating an awful lot we're testing. We did chickpeas. We did lamb. Do we do?
No, we took chicken tikka masala and we made chicken. It with pork because that's what we happen to have.
And it was fantastic.
And it worked just as well.
Great, great. I mean, that's the beauty of the concept. I mean, granted, we still present it with a step, you know, an exact meal to create because we just wanted people to have a true North Indian food experience that wouldn't really have any avenues for mistakes. And we wanted to leave room for creative chefs to explore different avenues of flavor profiles.
Now, is your market the home cook or the chefs?
Wow. It's the home cook. This is all about people in the mood to take that time and just make a great meal. And I just think that, you know, 10 to 15 minutes is not too much.
No, I mean, it's really simple. And how long before you mail one of these, have you compounded these spices? What's the shelf life till we get it?
They last for 2 years, but, you know, you'll rarely find that they you would receive a packet, you know, for placing an online order that had been sitting in our warehouse or in our office for that amount of time. We find we constantly, you know, we've been doing this for so long that we can really formulate these niche batches and in a timetable, you know, such a great streamline of business where we're just doing production every 4 to 5 months. So if it is a 2-year shelf table, I mean, you should be getting products that were manufactured 4 or 5 months ago.
I see. Now, what about your awards? You just got Entrepreneur of the Year for organics?
No. I was awarded from Cranes in New York City, one of the small business entrepreneurs in New York City, because of my work at Aurora Creations, Inc. as the owner of the company. I had tears in my eyes.
Uh-huh. I should think you did. I bet your mother was proud of you, too. Huh?
When I saw her, I hugged her and just started crying and crying and crying. It's a pretty big deal. I mean, it was a life story, you know, from everything.
And you've been in business for how long?
The company, we had products, 6-7 years. We had products on this, 2001 of New York City. We had some local markets just putting it together by hand. 2002, we were officially, you know, established as a corporation. The summer of 2002, we did a massive, you know, New York City flea market summertime, and you know, by the end of the year we were in Whole Foods.
Wow, you really moved.
well, we found out about you, Dheeraj, and you didn't even know this, from a chef who is at no less a place than Kenron Ranch.
Yeah.
In Lenox, Massachusetts. I'm going to send you the information so that you know who it is. So you're finding your way into restaurant kitchens as well. You wouldn't describe this as a shortcut, would you? You'd just describe it as the right ingredients being mixed together.
Yes.
I see. Now, you've spent time traveling all over the world. Do you spend a lot of time in India?
Oh, a phenomenal amount of time. And it's actually, I would like to think that's a great reason why I'm successful, because, you know, coming from an Indian background, you know, falling in love with my culture and my country and the cuisine, and having that as the inspiration that, you know, here I am, a young Indian man raised in the West, presenting my culture's food to my comrades of the West and communities all over the world. I'm pretty sure that gives me some extra juice.
Yeah, wow. That's really terrific.
Well,
we've actually had this experience before of people, you know, going back to a native land that they came from. In a couple of cases, reinventing the cuisine. What you've done is to go back and say, no, the traditional way is what I want to present to people.
Yeah, well, what about Nirmala? She rediscovered her roots, too.
Right.
You know our friend Nirmala? Nirmala's Kitchen?
She's, you know, she's in the business. She's in the stores. She's at the trade shows.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart, yeah.
Yeah, she's done, I think she's done a phenomenal job with almost, you know, more of a Asian food overall, bringing it.
Well, her spice background is in the Guianas but it's people of an Eastern ancestry who just happened to settle in that part of the world. So,
oh, of course, the British West Indies, the Dutch West Indies.
There are a lot of similarities between what she's doing and what you're doing. I think that what appealed to us, what we thought was so special, and what obviously your customers feel so special, is that you've created this masala, which I was smart enough to investigate, and I found out it just means a mixture. sounds like something a whole lot more complicated than that.
That's right. You kept saying to me, what is this masala?
we had a great claim to fame, which was in January of 2005, we launched the first ever, and at that time, for quite some time, the only but certified organic USDA Indian grocery product. So if you talked about
that's
Indian
wonderful.
Food, if you talked about an Indian grocery category, we really stood out.
Oh, that's really super.
Okay. Well, Dheeraj, I'll bet we'll see you at the Fancy Food Show in New York in July.
Yes. And or maybe even in San Diego down in
We're going to skip San Diego, but we always come to New York, so we'll be sure to look out for you then. I know your day is hectic, we're going to let you go. But do you have a last thought for our listeners?
www.auroracreations.com.
There you go.
A-R-O-R-A, creations with an S, one word, all lowercase. Mention that you found out about us from this interview, and in the comments section on the website, request a free sample. It'd be my honor.
Oh, okay. Good. I think I'm going to sneak in there, too.
you know what? You're a wonderful young man, because you're a fabulous amalgamation of an Indian heritage and the good old American way.
And at the same time, you sent me a message. I sent you a kit. You fell in love with the food. That's what I'm here to do. I've devoted my life to exposing this cuisine to the Western world. It is the food of England. They don't have an Indian background. Give me 30 years, and we'll turn about 150 million people into Indian.
And I have to tell you, the funny thing: this interview has been quite dynamic in terms of its scheduling. I'm glad we were able to get it together. I know you had a car accident. I hope you make a fast recovery from it.
Thank you.
And we wish you continued success, dear Arjun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Be in touch, everybody. Cheers. Happy holidays.
Ciao. Bye.
Bye.
And now we're going to take a break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, which I hope is a refreshing habit. Not refreshing, a usual habit. It's refreshing that I say good morning to Peter.
Yeah, and within the definition of habit, aside from what monks wear, is that you do it regularly.
Right.
At least once a week.
And we also would like to hear from you regularly at On the Menu, at onthemenuradio.com. We'd like to have feedback. We're talking, as usual, to a fascinating guest. We always have fascinating guests. And yes.
Well, we have
Andy Nusser.
How many guests have we had on the program? We've met Salvador Dali.
Oh, yeah. Andy's met Salvador Dali.
You're about the first, and you have to explain how
that
happened.
How did you know that? How did that happen? Let's see. I was in Catacape. I was 18 years old. I rode my bicycle into that town, and it was a dead end. This was back in the day when Dali and Gala liked to have people come over to their house and have a cocktail at the end of the day so they can, like, show whoever's in the village that seems, you know, remotely interested or interesting would come over there, and he would show us what he was painting that day. So a car picked us up at the casino, which is a really popular cafe right in town, which is, the town is so tiny. And then we took a little Citroën, drove up to his house. Guardia de Seville were all surrounding the whole place, and they let us in. And I'm standing in Dali's house, and I could see Gala, and I could see Dali. And he comes in and pops open some pink champagne. He wasn't drinking, so he toasted by putting his pinky in the pink champagne, or cava, I'm sure, rosé. And then proceeded just to ask me a lot of questions. And Gala was sitting right next to me and rubbing her hands on my knee a lot.
Yeah. So they were real cases. Huh?
Maybe we should stop.
But I was very happy to be there, no question. And
now how old were you?
I was 18.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is not, ladies and gentlemen, in the listening audience, the reason why Andy Nusser, the chef of Casamono, New York City, is on the program, although we could probably enjoy ourselves talking about that too, especially since we've been in the same wonderful town of Cadiz and we're quite charmed by it and understand why somebody might, like Salvador Dali, might like to live there.
And were there a lot of people at the party?
No. There was one, my cycling buddy at the time, and a drummer that was from Massachusetts that had a black derby hat on, and he was playing rock and roll at the Leo Stahl. And so it was just the three of us that went in there and listened. And you know, it was just one of these regretful things where I said, well, why didn't I get him to sign a poster? I was just there for the moment, and it makes a great story, and I will never forget it.
Why you could have gotten him to autograph a 9-pound cookbook if you happened to have one around at the time, because this is the proximate reason for Andy being on the program is that he was invited to contribute, and this is a signal accomplishment in its own right for an American-based chef who cooks in the Spanish style to have his recipes included in a book which has 1,080 recipes.
It's called 1080.
The Bible of cooking in Spain that has just become available in English, and we have a copy which is breaking Anne's leg as we speak.
No, this is the first time it's ever been printed in English, but it's gone on for how long, how many years in Spain?
30 years they spent in Spanish, and so I mean it was pretty much the dog-eared greasy cookbook in every Spaniard's kitchen, because it's pretty much the joy of cooking, and it's not the foam recipe, you know, molecular gastronomy approach. This is, you know, how to make everything, and so to have it translated and illustrated the way it is, it's just, it becomes a Bible, and well, you know, it's just an incomplete. A complete honor, I should say, to be included with it, because the other chefs that were asked were like, wow. So, anyway.
The illustrations, by the way, are Javier Mariscal.
Yes, and thank you.
Absolutely. They're just whimsical, wonderful, right on, colorful, just absolutely with a book. What a book that weighs 9 pounds should have to lighten it.
Now, how long? How many years have you been using this? You've probably been using this as your Bible for some time, I guess.
Well, I mean, you have to have a book that you use that you always go back to. And basically, being a Spanish-inspired chef in New York City, you are bastardizing or, you know, changing things because you are not in Spain. But what I like to do is go with an original recipe and then do what I can with it and, you know, keep the integrity the best I can. So this is the book to do that.
Now, let's go back a little bit, though. You were 18 and
yeah.
being patted on the knee by Salvador Dali's wife.
Right. I was a dishwasher in a restaurant that's still there called Casa Noon.
And then you became a chef. Somewhere along the way, you became a chef.
Well, it was, my father kind of planted the seed by keep on taking me back to Spain. And then from Spain, we moved to New York. So we kind of ran out of money. It was cheaper to fly back to New York than it was to California. We knew his brother. So we lived in New York City, and we stayed here. And I went to high school, and then I eventually went back to California. But it was in retrospect, and after I had opened up Casa Mono, and my mother came to visit, and my dad had died, and I said, you know, it's funny that, you know, you created this, the fact that I'd been living in Spain as a kid, and I went back, and then, you know, I lived in New York. That is why I'm a Spanish chef in New York. And I just thanked my mother completely, and that was like 3 weeks ago. It was a beautiful moment.
Now, how did you become it? You glossed over how you became a chef.
Oh, well, that's an interesting story. It was definitely a career change. I definitely wanted to do it, but I had the mindset for it, and I think I had the creative outlet because I was really involved with art. But I didn't really have the training, and so every friend that was a chef, including, you know, I knew Mario back then too, because I met him in Santa Barbara in the 80s.
Now he is your partner.
Right, he's my partner in Casa Mono, and he's like, well, whatever you do, don't do a culinary school. That's just a waste of time. You know, just get your feet wet by going into a restaurant that you admire and go. So of course I didn't do that. You know, I did the other route. I went to the Culinary Institute, and I'm working in hotels. I'm doing everything I really shouldn't be doing. But I was getting training, and I was getting, you know, I was getting my sea leg or whatever. So when I actually felt like I was ready to cook, I started working with him, and we worked at Poe, and then we worked at Babbo, and it was in 2003 that we opened up Casa Mono as partners.
Well, now let's go back to 1080. Is that the colloquial name for the book?
I just discovered.
Yeah, everyone's calling it 1080. Yes.
Four recipes and 5 pages for cardoons.
There you go. Well, I guess if you have cardoons growing in your garden, you need more than one recipe.
I think there's probably any recipe.
I have cardoons on my menu. They're the most forgettable thing because they're so delicious, and you must, because there's a certain point of the year where artichokes become so expensive that you can't use it. And a cardoon is the perfect replacement. It's a thistle. It's as if you've
I was raised on it, yeah. It's an Italian thing, not just
Italian. Yeah, exactly.
It's
the bagnacalla and the cardoons, yeah.
My mother-in-law used to grow it in the garden, right here. It was not very successful, but she did grow it.
Look, here's fried sorrel. I've always wanted to know what to do with all that sorrel besides make soup.
Yeah, well, what I do is that once you slice them into sticks, like the size of a pencil, then you can I cook them in kava and with a little bit of lemon juice and lots of water and chili flakes, and then. You know, drain them out and cool them down, and then you can do anything with them. You can fry them, you can grill them, and then, you know, but they become, you know, palatable because they're pretty fibrous. You have to really kind of
let it get real big to get this kind of a fiber on it in the stalks.
So back to 1080. Is 1080 a cook's cookbook or is it a...
I think it has a history of being like a housewife or, you know, a grandma's cookbook, which is what I always use for inspiration. I try to pretend, or not pretend, but I'm more of a grandma than I am of a chef. And then when I keep that, you know, humble humility and simplicity involved with the food, then I can't help but embellishing upon it, and so it becomes, you know, it becomes restaurant food. But my roots are basically, you know, things of joy of cooking.
Well, see, in English, it's the joy of cooking. It's what you give brides for wedding presents.
Yes, exactly. That
in
right.
Italy, we already interviewed those people a couple years back. It's the silver spoon.
Exactly. Same people, same principle, different pantry. We moved from to the Iberian Peninsula, so they're going to be talking about jamones instead of, you know, prosciutto, and they're going to be talking about manchego instead of Parmigiano Reggiano.
Now, why do you think that Spanish food has become so immensely popular? Is it all Ferran Adrià, or is it more than that?
I think it has a huge thing to do with it. I think when I was just opening up, the cover of New York Times Magazine was his big face, and Ferran Adrià was definitely making a splash in New York. But I think that was definitely a factor. Another factor is just that it was retroactive. I mean, here's a country that makes brilliant food that was undiscovered, and it was time. And then the other thing that was really in fashion at that same moment, and still is small plates. And that concept of not having to invest in an entree that costs $40 and you can get a small plate that costs $12 became really approachable and attractive for the diner in this city. So Ferran Adrià, of course, was a huge springboard for Spanish food, and he still is. But the fact that tapas, which, you know, became almost anything, you know, the word was just thrown out, it had lost its meaning. But the small place, the flash of Ferran Adrià, and the fact that Spanish food was awesome and no one knew it, was just, it just collided, those three elements.
Yeah. I think also there was a great deal of new vigor into the tourist industry as a result of whenever those Olympics were.
Yeah, the Barcelona Olympics, I guess, was a big help.
Bingo. Yeah, I totally forget about that. But yeah, once you start studying the situation, yes.
I mean,
exactly.
When we were in school, we all trotted through there because it was so cheap. We hung around in Spain.
Right.
And, yeah. And
not so much anymore, but yeah.
Not now, you can't. So now.
Yeah.
Now
Europe on $5 a day. I did have that book.
Oh, yeah. But,
and it did work.
Yeah, but basically, I think after the Olympics and after the EU, that now it's attracting a whole different cadre of travelers. You're not getting poor, starving artists and students. You're getting that go to France and Italy.
They're going over there for the food.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's really like, why go to Italy? Why go to France? Let's go to Spain, because that's where all the good restaurants are.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Aren't they, though?
And you start thinking about everything in Barcelona, and then you can't forget about San Sebastian. You know, it's like the Michelin stars of restaurants that are over there, and then the fact that, you know, they have all the pinchos and tapas, and, you know, there's so many different avenues to disgust yourself.
Oh.
It's, you know, it's an amazing vacation.
Now, how often do you go?
The last time I was there, I took two trips to Jerez, and the first time was because I was a competitor for to compare sherry with food. And so I did three different dishes, and I was judged by Juli Soler, who was, of course, you know,
I know who he is, yeah.
And, you know, the fat duck.
Oh, don't you love, yeah.
Yeah, and so they were judging me, and I got a trophy. So I was like, oh, my God, this is great. I represented Team USA. I was right behind Team Japan. And Team Japan had like, ooh, God, I don't know, like 16 chefs. It was ridiculous. There was so many components on their plates. And so I'm going up with my fried egg with potatoes and mojama. So right behind them. So anyway, I got a trophy for a foie gras dish that I paired with sherry, and they loved it. And so it was through that I went on a return sort of like victory tour where they paid my way so I didn't have to cook or anything. And I was down in the same neck of the woods at Puerto de Santa Maria and Jerez and Cadiz. And beautiful, beautiful place, yes.
Oh,
I mean, my heart's in Cadiz and the Costa Brava, but I just love the opportunity to go back at any time.
Yeah, well, we did. We have friends, can you picture, Swedish friends that retired and moved and built a house in Nerja, near Malaga.
Which is near Malaga.
Oh, yeah. I lived my parents always were kind of like racing around. There was a point that we lived in Torre Molinos, which is certainly not the highlight of our world at all. And I think that was James Michener coined it best, that it was like touring a sewer in a glass-bottom boat, that it was just gone. It was just, there was nothing Spanish about it. Here's a town you couldn't even speak Spanish in.
No,
these
are all English. These are all English people there.
Yeah, exactly.
Be nice.
We rented a house there for about a month, and we're like, okay, we're out of here.
Was that because your father was an artist?
Yes, he was, yeah.
And the, so you just...
He reached a point where in his life where he had retired, and he did the math, and he thought, you know what, I think it was some Sunday morning, my parents were lying in bed, and they realized if they sold their house, they can go to Spain for, you know, X amount of time, and so they just did it. So, you know, of course, you know, I was in the seventh grade, and so I had to go to the junior high and get enough books for 2 years, and we lugged those around, and we were, you know, I guess the word is homeschooled, but... it really paid off for me because, you know, I was learning Spanish and reading a lot more. There's very little television back then over there. So It really came out, you know, I would do the same thing to my kid. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, it sounds like a
wonderful idea. Well, we're going to ask you the really hard question now.
Okay, I'm ready.
You have 1080 recipes. Pick your four favorites.
Well, I'll pick three of them.
Three, okay, three's fine.
Go in the back, and there's this incredible recipe for sweetbreads, which are almond dust and deep fried. And people typically don't buy sweetbreads, which is kind of a silly thing to do because it's the easiest thing in the world to cook and they're the most...
Come on, wait a minute. Now, you're telling me they're the easiest thing in the world to cook. People sometimes give me sweetbreads, and I can't cook them.
You can't figure out how to peel them is the worst part.
Well, it's not just...
You're thinking too hard because then, you know, if you peel them too much, they're going to all fall apart and you're not
going to
have anything holding together, so you really don't.
What is my problem? They always end up like rocks.
All right, so you're going to look at something that's not going to be pretty, and there's the theory of the things that don't look pretty that taste really good fall into the sweetbread category.
Great, well, you got one. I'm going to definitely want you to cook for me. Go ahead.
All right, but yeah, you have to rinse the sweetbreads, and you put them in boiling water, and the water will stop boiling because they're cold, and then they'll come up to a simmer again, and as soon as they do, you flash them and you put them in ice water, and at that point, they're ready to be cooked the second time, and that's where you do your magic. But if you just start cooking it from that point, then they are going to be hard to walk. So you have to cook twice, but that's the first thing you have to do.
Where is this? Is it under what?
Sorry, again?
How do I find this in the book?
It's under Andy Nusser.
There you go. Okay, what's the next? That's one. How about two?
There's a gazpacho salad, which is a great idea because it's gazpacho, of course, is all the components that are obliterated in a blender and they're delicious, but the components by themselves make it also an awesome salad. So if you take cucumbers and onions and tomatoes and make it into a salad, it is such a perfect accompaniment for seafood. And so you can grill lobster or cigales or langoustine and grill them and put them on top of this gazpacho salad. That is awesome. And then last but not least would be the rhubarb. Rhubarb flan is something that is, flan by itself is typically used with caramel, but there's so many other things like jellies and pectins that you could easily replace the caramel for the flan. And so what you do is you take rhubarb and cook it with sugar until it's very syrupy and make that your syrup for your flan and then pour your custard into that. So when you turn it upside down, it has this beautiful rhubarb color. And that is the perfect meal in itself, that you'd have a langoustine gazpacho salad, the fried sweetbreads with a, that's been dusted in almonds and then finished with a rhubarb flan.
There we go. Not just three dishes, but a whole menu.
And here we have, on page 938, we've got Carme Ruscalleda.
Oh, no kidding. What's she cooking?
Green noodles, fideo verde. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, good. And quick shrimp soup and an apricot sponge.
Ooh, that would work.
Biscocho de albarico.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Wonderful Spanish.
Well, honey,
wonderful Spanish.
I was studying Italian.
Andy, we could.
Oh, here's Santi Santa Maria. He's
there
a
There we go. We went to his place twice.
He's a
Yeah, I appreciate that.
You do?
You've been to my place twice, you just said?
No, I said we've been to Santi Santa Maria's place twice.
Oh, yeah.
Casa Bona is on the next trip. Yeah, we have you lined up as a place we'd like to try the next time we're in New York. I hope we'll be welcome.
Oh, God, I'd be waiting with bells on.
I know we're running out of time, but I wanted... Why did you get so much heat in Heat?
Well... Bill Buford is kind of like the Bill Plimpton guy, you know, and his book that he wrote before was Among the Thugs, and that was all about soccer playing at Manchester, England, and he kind of submerged himself in that whole world to write about
soccer. Oh, you're talking about George
Bill. I'm talking about Bill Buford.
that you're talking about George, the Plimpton you're talking about is George Plimpton.
George, yeah, exactly.
George is the one, he's the one who suited up to be in the boxing ring and played quarterback in the NFL and all kinds of crazy
exactly.
things.
Exactly. So that's the same sort of thinking that, of submerging himself in there. And then Bill did that, and he was interested in writing about the restaurant world, so he definitely submerged himself into the restaurant world, and he worked in a kitchen with me for a year. And he was always, you know, had his notepad and writing things. And I had no idea, you know, that I would be part of it or anything, you know. And so it turned out that he was really interested in the fact that I was breaking away from the restaurant and opening up Cosimono. And he documented it. And, you know, and it's very warts and all sort of thing, you know, because it's like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that I was such a bad person.
Well, you know, I'm surprised half the people in the book talked to him after it was published.
Hold on, please.
Say again?
I said I'm surprised that half the people in the book talk to him after the book was published.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's like, you know, Truman Capote when he wrote Answered Prayers, and all those people were like going, you wrote about me. It's like, well, I'm a writer. That's what I do. Yeah, what did you think?
Yeah, we just saw a movie about Truman Capote when he was writing In Cold Blood. It reminded me of reading that book back in the early 1960s when I was in college. It's hard to imagine that my life has lasted this long. and the thesis of this movie was that Truman Capote essentially stopped dead and didn't really produce anything creative after that. The experience of being involved with the kids and these murders stopped his career. That obviously hasn't happened to Andy Nusser, who made famous by Michael Ruman. There's a future after Ruman.
No, sweetheart, you have it all. Just stop while you're ahead.
No.
I'm ahead.
I'm not that superstitious. So,
but listen, you call us back sometime and just talk, even when we're not doing a program. Because this is fun.
Yeah,
you're the dish whip.
Yeah, the restaurant is called Cosimono. The website is CosimonoNYC.com. The cookbook is 1080
recipes.
You can obtain it through the OTM bookshelf on the OTM website.
On the menu, radio.com
and the OTM bookshelf. And if you're interested in exploring Spanish, even if you're not interested in cooking it, this is a book that you ought to have.
And you should read it and see the wonderful illustrations, whimsical illustrations.
Andy, we better let you go back, otherwise people are going to Cosimono tonight will have no dinner.
Thank you both. It's been very fun. Thank you so much.
Absolutely hilarious. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right, happy holidays.
Ciao.
Same to you.
Bye.
And it's time to take a break.
It's time to take a break.
And listeners, we'll hope you'll stay with us, and we'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
I'm still here.
You're still here?
It's absolutely amazing. I'm still here as the year is
you
drawing.
You always accuse me of ignoring you, and I don't.
The year is drawing to a close.
It is.
So I'm entitled to make an appearance.
Well, you're always here. You're here when I'm not here.
And we have another excellent and interesting guest.
A fabulous product.
Yeah, from the Pacific Northwest. I don't know why it is that. Why is it that the left side of the country somehow seems more innovative than the right side when it comes to food? Do you have any ideas about that?
Oh, I have no idea.
There's
some great food that's happening out here on the West Coast.
But you can quote the opening lines of The Three Witches from Macbeth as a sound check. Now, not all of our guests can do that.
Too many years spent at the Oregon Shakespearean Festival.
Hey, there is one of those, huh? Well, that's not the reason we're talking today. We're talking because Art and his business partner make some absolutely splendid...
His name is Art Pollard.
Art Pollard,
did you say that?
I just said Art.
Art Pollard.
I'm being corrected, as always, on the air.
And his business partner have Amano Chocolate. Now, where does Amano come from?
Amano means by hand.
By hand. Amano, Italiano.
They love.
Oh, it does, too. They love Amo. Amano. That's right. Amano.
Get off that one.
No, I'm
move
trying
on.
To think.
Move
he's,
on.
He's conjugating in Italian, though, right?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I got this a little petrified because I thought maybe you were doing Latin, and I don't remember that.
No, I could do that one.
Amo amasa mat.
Amama Samate Sament.
Okay.
There you go. That's,
there, throws that up against your Macbeth.
That's a limit. That's a limit of my schoolboy Latin that I can remember.
Now, you have not always been an artisan chocolatier, as I understand it. How did you get to doing this?
I grew up in a little town in New Mexico called Los Alamos, which is where the National Laboratory is.
Yes.
So you grow up with the idea that if you want to do something, you just go do it. And so when I was in college, I was working for the physics department at my university, and I thought it would be interesting to make my own chocolate, kind of on a whim. And everybody told me, you can't do that. My response was, boy, that sounds interesting. So a few years later, I started to design and build my own chocolate refiner.
Now, how long ago was that?
Oh, I started building the refiner probably about 10 years ago.
Now, uh-huh. You don't actually go out and buy one? I mean, you just decided to build one?
Yeah, I decided to build one.
You build a better one?
It does a very good job at what it does. And after a fair amount of working on it, I kind of perfected that design, and then it shifted into, well, how good a chocolate can I actually make? And after I started working with recipes and various techniques, the quality of the chocolate just kept improving and improving and improving. And it wasn't long before friends, neighbors, local chefs started hounding me for it, and of course I had been totally bit by the chocolate bug at that point. And
now, what's the secret in the equipment, or is the secret in the beans? I mean, we've had various points of view on that question.
You know, there is not a step in the entire process that's not absolutely critical for producing a fine quality chocolate.
Now, you're called here in this press release, I'm looking at, the upstart chocolate maker. Why is that? Because it says you nabbed all these top honors. You were even named, what was it here? I just had it here. You were the most creative or something?
I think it was most gifted chocolateer.
Most gifted chocolateer.
At the San Francisco Chocolate Salon, yeah.
Right. And you also, did we see you at NAF in New York in July?
Yes.
That's when we saw you.
We won an award there, too.
Right. And talk to us about your process, because at first we interviewed the guy from Theo, which mm-hmm. I also adore his chocolate,
mm-hmm.
but he at the time was the only one who sourced and imported and then roasted his own beans. Now, what do you do?
Well, actually, we do all that. Theo's arrangement there is that they're the only ones that do that with organic. And we do the same thing. We travel down to the farms, and we work with the farmers, and we source and import our own cocoa beans.
But they're not organic. Is that the difference?
Not necessarily. Sometimes we buy, if we purchase organic beans. Our overall focus isn't so much on a label, but on achieving absolutely total quality as far as the beans are concerned.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes that means we end up working with a farmer who has taken the time and spent the money to get his farm certified organic, and sometimes not.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean it's not all natural, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you sent Okumare?
Okumare, yeah.
Okumare and the Madagascar.
Right.
And they're both 70% cacao.
That's, yeah.
And what's the Cayuga we didn't get?
The Cuyagua, yes. They're both the Okumare and the Cuyagua, the beans originate in Venezuela.
Okay.
And, of course, on the Madagascar bar, the beans come from Madagascar. They come from a single plantation on the northwest coast.
But see, what I asked you off-air to explain is, the thing that was amazing is that besides that intense bittersweet chocolate taste you get with the high cacao, you have undercurrents of other flavors in yours. And where does that come from, and how do you get that?
That is just a natural part of the beans that we work with. We work with beans that have really high quality genetics. typically people will refer to that as having a high criollo content, which is a variety of tree that originated out of Venezuela.
Now, what kind of content?
Criollo.
How do you spell that?
C-R-I-O-L-L-I-O.
Okay, I think I read somewhere that well over 90% of the cocoa beans that you get are from a different kind of tree that's common in Africa. Am I right there?
Right.
I forget the name of that.
Yeah, those are the forest taro.
That's the one.
And the forest taro has a really strong, rich chocolate flavor, but misses a lot of the nuances
that you can get with it. That's the difference.
It's the nuances that, to me, make this different and special.
Yeah.
Do you know Clay Gordon from Discover Chocolate?
Yes, I know Clay very well.
He was on the program just a few weeks ago, and that was one of the things that we talked about.
Art here is a scientist by training, so does this, now that you've solved the issue of producing the scrumptious chocolate, do you still have a scientist curiosity to pursue the chocolate venture?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I love about working with chocolate is, besides the wonderful response that we've received from the public, is that for me it's something where there's no end of learning. So we'll be doing this for quite some time.
So there are more kinds of chocolate in the future, you think?
Oh, yes. We're working on a number of different new bars.
So you do only bars, though, right?
Currently, we're actually just starting to offer some of our chocolate available from our website for chefs. So
that in the raw for them to use?
Right.
Baking chocolate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, it would also be a 70%, but it would be packaged in a way that is conducive for chefing.
Yeah, what do you call this, little coins?
These are going to be, it's actually a bar. It's going to be a 10-ounce bar, and it'll have squares of 2 ounces each.
Okay, so it's a larger size and a larger.
And you can measure it.
Yeah,
right.
I suppose you could measure the bars we have, but the pieces are much smaller. Oh. I wonder why that is. Is that because three is the right quantity to eat at one time?
One of our secret plans.
I mean, by the time you break it down again, it's really not worth it, is it?
Now, you're a bit of a historian, researcher as well. How many of these old myths about chocolate, going back to the Aztecs and Montezuma, are accurate?
Oh, quite a few. Chocolate has had an absolutely incredibly amazing history, and I'd really encourage anybody who has an interest in chocolate to spend some time reading about it, because a lot of the stories that we've heard over the years and chalked them up to urban legend actually have a lot of their basis in truth.
Like what?
Well, one of the ones I've always really enjoyed is the fact that Sir Francis Drake, on one of his many exploits in the region, he captured some native canoes, and they were all filled with cocoa beans. And so he didn't figure out what to do with them. So the natives were really upset about his confiscating their cocoa beans. But since he didn't know what to do with them, he dumped them into the ocean. And he was a veritable fortune at the time. You know, I think, by today's standards, it's worth a fortune. So he ended up taking a few of the cocoa beans back to England, and I actually have a woodcut of some of the original cocoa beans he brought back with him. But it's just amazing the impact that chocolate has made on the world's history, and to think that one of the earliest European explorers just dumped them into the ocean, not knowing their true value.
Well, I guess there are a group of American colonists who didn't know very much about making tea either, so they decided to make it with cold salt water. But I guess that's another part of history. Well, where can people get their Amano fix?
Well, it's available off of our website, which is www.amano.com. But we're also in a wide variety of specialty grocery stores all around the country.
And is there a store locator on your website?
Unfortunately, there isn't at this time, but I'm sure that if your listening audience goes in to their local specialty store, there's a reasonable chance that they will be there. If not, please ask your retailer to contact us, and we'll be happy to work with them.
Yeah, I mean, I can vouch for this. It's pure heaven, this chocolate.
Yeah, and Miss Ann does not eat very much chocolate. If she says it's good, it's got to be good.
It's good.
If Ann says it's good, it's got to be good.
Well, we only try to make the very best.
Well, that's a wonderful motto, and from coming away from Los Alamos totally irradiated as well as totally educated, it's wonderful to have you making such a great contribution to sweetening American life. What a wonderful thought to finish out the year of 2007.
Right.
We wish you a happy and a prosperous 2008. We wish the same to all of our listeners across the world.
Right.
Well, thank you.
And I guess we'll make our first appearance next week.
Same time, same place. It'll be the fifth or the sixth year of On the Menu. I'm not sure which.
Oh, shoot. That long,
That's
huh?
pretty scary.
Oh,
huh?
My.
That's pretty scary.
Good.
Well, once again, thank you so much for joining us. And say hello to your partner and keep up the great work and keep us posted about all the new things that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, until next week.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on the program. Until next week and until next year. Goodbye, Mrs. Rabbit.
Goodbye. Bye-bye, we say.
We do. And welcome back to On the Menu next week.